This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. In 1996, a Democratic incumbent president faced a challenge from a Republican nominee the GOP faithful were slow to warm to. In 1984, the incumbent president performed poorly in his first debate. In 1960, those who watched the presidential candidate's debate on TV were convinced one won, while those listening on radio or reading transcripts after the fact felt the other made better points. Every presidential election year, there is a reason to look back, to compare how the campaign is playing out to the last election, or the one before that, or the one before that. While every election brings its own issues and conditions and the attitudes and makeup of the electorate itself changes, there may well be some lessons to be learned from recent history which can inform why this year's campaign is playing out as it is. And for as many parallels we may find, there may be many more contrasts, examples of how the political world has changed that might be worth exploring as well. So today on the program, we will look back to explore parallels and maybe some contrasts as well between the 2012 presidential election and elections from the past 50 years or so. We have two guests with us this morning. Alan Lichtman is a professor of history at American University in Washington, D.C. Professor Lichtman, welcome to Focus.
My great pleasure.
Glad to have you with us.
Thanks.
And John Jackson is a visiting professor at the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University. Professor Jackson, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you with us. And we welcome you to the conversation as well. To join us on air, call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome your questions and comments on WILL's Facebook page, and you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is willpublicmedia. We could start any number of places, gentlemen, but I think since we're having this discussion after the first presidential debate and before the vice presidential debate, and since polling out yesterday suggested that if the election were held now, it would be much tighter in terms of results than polls just a couple of weeks before had suggested. So let's start there. In the past 50 years or so, have there been some notable instances of first debate performances changing the narrative of the campaign? Let me start with Professor Lichtman.
Certainly there has. The classic example is, of course, 1984, when Ronald Reagan seemed to be old, befuddled, out of touch. It totally changed the narrative because Reagan was so heavily favored to win re-election and Walter Mondale seemed like a very weak candidate. After all, he was the guy who told the Democratic convention that he was going to raise taxes. Well, Mondale decisively won that first debate, and the narrative became, it's now a race. Mondale is back in it. Fortunately for Reagan, he came back with a strong performance in the second debate, but fundamentally the debates didn't change anything. Ultimately, the election returned to right where it had been before the debates, and that is a decisive victory for President Ronald Reagan.
Professor Jackson, any other instances of first debate performances that maybe changed the narrative of a given campaign?
Well, I think the closest parallel overall to this election is the parallel with 2004. You had an incumbent, you had a challenger from Massachusetts, you had George W. Bush having been in the White House for a whole term and trying to get a renewal on his lease for a second term. Bush did not do as well as Kerry in that first debate. Ultimately, it didn't make any difference. I think these things come and go. The bounce sometimes is there, but whether or not it lasts is the bigger question, and I think the parallel with 2004 is the closest one for all of the contours of this election.
Professor Lichtman, whether we're talking about 1984 or 2004, in comparison to 2012, what then should each campaign currently take away from such parallels?
Well, I think what the Obama campaign should take away from is he needs to change course in the second debate. Whoever was advising him in the first debate ought to be banished to a Pacific island very, very far away. He was told to be passive, not to challenge Romney, no matter what Romney said, to stay away from being aggressive. This was a debate. It wasn't a speech. It was perhaps one of the worst performances in debate history. He's got to totally change course in the second debate and engage, sell his programs, and I think most importantly, spell out in very clear terms what his vision is for the next 4 years. After all, this is going to be a very difficult 4 years, and if he gets reelected, he has to have a mandate. Otherwise, it's going to be a tough second term, and so far he has no mandate. Of course, Mitt Romney has to be very careful not to skate on his very strong performance in the first debate, and to recognize that he is going to face a very different kind of Barack Obama in debate number two.
Professor Jackson, would you agree with those assessments?
Yes, I do. The situation is going to be dramatically different. My understanding of the rules of this game this time are that it will be more the town hall give and take with the audience, so that changes the dynamic very considerably. Surely the president knows how to get ready for these things. Surely the advisors must have learned from this last go-round. I think he will be more relaxed and more comfortable, but he can't be as relaxed as he was last time, and he's got to engage not only Romney but the audience.
Professor Lichtman, as I mentioned, the vice presidential debate would be the next one that we will see later this week. Historically, what impact have vice presidential debates had on presidential campaigns?
Pretty much zero. Vice presidents just don't count. The only example that I think is even possible to dredge up from recent history, say the history of post-World War II elections, would be 1960. Of course, you didn't have a vice presidential debate, but arguably Lyndon Johnson might have turned Texas for John F. Kennedy. But even without Texas, John F. Kennedy would still have won that election. There's no subsequent example of a vice president tipping anything. Perhaps the worst beating any vice presidential candidate ever had was Dan Quayle in 1988 when he compared himself to a young John F. Kennedy because he was being derided as young and inexperienced. And Lloyd Benson, the elder statesman who was very experienced from Texas, came back and said, "Sir, I knew John Kennedy. John Kennedy was a friend of mine, and you, sir, are no John Kennedy." It was just utterly deflating. Did it make any difference? No. George H.W. Bush still went on to handily defeat Michael Dukakis in that election. Now, that said, I don't think a vice presidential debate will change the contours of this race. I don't even think the first presidential debate fundamentally changed it. I think ultimately you're going to come around to the incumbent winning. But I do think the narrative of the campaign could change. If Joe Biden, who's kind of rightly derided, most people think Ryan is going to win this debate, comes on with a very strong performance and really pokes holes in the Ryan-Romney position, the narrative could change. So remember, there's a dynamic in the press as well. It's not just the reality out there of the election. It's the fact that the press has to write a story every single day. And they can't write the same story. For a while, it was Obama momentum. That was the story. The press was delighted to switch the story to Romney catching up and Romney getting momentum, and they'll be just as thrilled to change the story as well if Joe Biden does well in this debate.
Professor Jackson, if first you agree with that assessment of how narratives are weaved during presidential campaigns, assuming that, can we look back and say, oh, in past presidential campaigns going back several decades, that's always been the case, that there's been this sort of overwhelming narrative and it shifts and weaves and develops over the course of the campaign?
Yes, absolutely. Timothy Krause, long ago after the 1972, I think it was, campaign, wrote a book called The Boys on the Bus, and he talked about that narrative and how all the media get on the same story and tell the same story over and over the next two or three days. I agree entirely with what was said. I would simply add, it's clear that the administration, President Obama and Joe Biden, would like to change the narrative if possible. I think the parallel this time with 2008 with Sarah Palin being young and the non-incumbent going in virtually unknown and getting credit for doing better than expected is likely what the Ryan camp is shooting for. Whether or not they get that, I think, remains to be seen. I don't think the vice presidential debate is ultimately going to be a game changer either way, but it would be preferable for the Obama people to get a new story coming out of the media the next day. It's not really who objectively won the thing, particularly on substance. I think Romney won on style, but not on substance. I think the president won on substance, but that, never mind. That's not the story that everybody ran with the next day. So they would like to change
the subject. Professors don't set the narrative, do they?
I'm sorry?
We professors don't set the narrative.
You're right. Exactly.
Professor Jackson, you mentioned 1972. As we're talking about vice presidents and vice presidential nominees and their roles in campaigns, that's a year I think a lot of people don't spend a lot of time thinking about these days. But that was the vice presidential nominee, and that process played a significant role in that.
Well,
election.
Yeah, that's a very good point. It's a different story, of course, and that is Tom Eagleton's story being replaced. McGovern wasn't going to win anyway, but nevertheless, it could have been less of a disaster for the Democrats. But the first impression people got of McGovern's decision-making was, number one, putting Tom Eagleton on, number two, not vetting him adequately, and number three, bailing out on him.
And before we go any further, maybe just I'm bearing in mind that we have a lot of listeners,
right,
in many cases maybe weren't even alive in 1972.
Yes, right.
And so maybe we should give them a little bit of background. So George McGovern was the Democratic nominee.
Yes.
And he had selected Thomas Eagleton to serve as his,
Missouri.
as his running mate.
Right.
What happened next?
Two or three days later, it was disclosed that Tom Eagleton had had depression to such an extent that he had had to have shock treatments. It became an enormous story. I never quite understood why, because that was a standard procedure back in those days. But at any rate, it got to be so controversial that the Democratic National Committee ultimately accepted Tom Eagleton's resignation from the ticket and put Sergeant Shriver on, with, of course, the active support of the nominee, George McGovern. And by then, the election was effectively over, is my reading of it.
And Professor Lichtman, what I find interesting about this is that while all of that was playing out, it sort of pales historically in comparison to what we ultimately remember the 1972 election for. In particular, the Watergate break-in and then everything that followed.
We don't remember the 1972 election for the Watergate break-in. That's what's so fascinating about it. George McGovern ran all over the country in the 1972 campaign saying the Nixon administration is the most corrupt administration in the history of the country. And he was essentially correct. But nobody believed him. This was just poor old George, 20 points behind in the polls, trying to gin up an issue. Yes, the Watergate break-in occurred in June of 1972, well before the general election campaign. But the dam of silence, the cover-up, sorry, George, did not break until early 1973. And so, in fact, the Watergate scandal never gained any traction during the campaign itself, but of course blew apart the Nixon second term and turned Nixon's victory into a truly pyrrhic one.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're exploring parallels between the 2012 presidential election and elections from the past 50 years or so. We're talking with Alan Lichtman, professor of history at American University in Washington, and John Jackson, visiting professor at the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University. We welcome you to the conversation as well at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-9455. WILL. You can also email your question or comment to will-talk at illinois.edu. We may have touched on this briefly, but I do want to ask each of you that if you had to pick one presidential campaign from the last 50 years or so to compare this year to, debates aside, one year that you'd say played out similarly, at least thus far, to how this year is playing out, which would you choose and why? Professor Lichtman?
Well, I think Professor Jackson nailed it right at the beginning here. It's obviously 2004 when you had an incumbent who had some significant problems, whose approval rating was about hovering around 50% or just below 50%, who is facing a challenger from Massachusetts who had issues of his own and who did not perform particularly well in the presidential debates, but nonetheless had enough going for him. Things were not so bad as yet that the American people were ready to reject the party in power. I think that is hauntingly similar to precisely what is going on in this campaign today.
Well, I agree, of course, and I would add to that the similarities between Mitt Romney and John Kerry, both from Massachusetts, both being very patrician and super rich, not very good at campaigning, not very good at all at relating to common, ordinary people and having a tin ear for the way real, down-to-earth, ordinary people live are striking to me, even though John Kerry, of course, was the Democrat and Mitt Romney is the Republican. The three candidates from Massachusetts that we've had going back to Dukakis are strikingly similar in lots of ways, but particularly similarities between John Kerry and Mitt Romney, even though they come from two ends of the continuum, are striking to me.
A couple of thoughts come to mind. One, first of all, I guess perhaps the Obama administration felt the same way and so turned to Senator Kerry to represent Mitt Romney in their debate prep, apparently.
Whatever debate prep they had did not show in the debate. I don't know what they were preparing for or what kind of practice they did, but it looked like, you know, someone woke up Obama 5 minutes before the debate and said, hurry up, guess what, you know, it's time to debate. It's like one of those bad dreams where you're, you know, on stage and you have no idea why you're there or what your lines are. That's what Obama looked at. It was an astonishingly off-center performance for someone who is such a great communicator. You know, I don't think Obama has recaptured the magic of 2008. And I would attribute it, having studied the presidency, to two things. One is the Washington bubble. Once you become president, you get caught in that bubble. You know, you're flying around everywhere in Air Force One. Everybody's bowing down to you, calling you Mr. President. Everyone is saying, yes, of course, Mr. President. You lose touch. And then secondly, the consultants, the handlers, and the ad men who always tell you don't take risks, don't be too specific, don't say anything that you can be attacked. If only Obama would have been himself, I think he would have done just fine. But being in the Washington bubble and being enthralled to the consultants, I think, has really hurt him. If I were to make one reform to our political process, it would be to take all the consultants, the hucksters, the ad men, and the pollsters, many of whom are good friends of mine, and send them off to a very nice Pacific island at the beginning of the campaign, far, far away from all of us.
I don't know. That would raise the unemployment rate, don't you think?
Yes, it would, and hurt the economy because they make so much money off these campaigns.
Professor Jackson, one of the reasons that I raise this question of using Senator Kerry in preparation for the debate is to point out those very factors that you had indicated, the similarities between the two of them. And yet, I wonder if there was a misconception about how similar those two men are. Specifically, I'm talking about Mitt Romney and John Kerry. If you look at some of the debates during the primary process among the Republicans, there were times when Governor Romney seemed rather aggressive, engaged, maybe not connecting with the common man. Maybe that part, you know, some will argue one way or the other whether that's true. But this idea that he's able to get ideas across in an effective and forceful way. We certainly saw that last week, didn't we?
Yes, I think the practice in 22 Republican primary debates was good for Mitt Romney, and he didn't have any hesitancy in just destroying people like Santorum and Rick Perry and so forth. He went after them with a vengeance, and I think the Obama people should have studied those tapes and figured out something about how it was going to go. I think I would theorize that they must have told Obama, don't be Al Gore, don't be Al Gore in 2000, where he just was too aggressive, and they took that to the extreme. I would point out, as one of those factoids that may or may not mean very much, that the president running for re-election in the first debate in the last three or four cycles where that applies has lost the first debate pretty decisively for all the reasons Professor Lichtman was just talking about, and then came back to do better, or ultimately all of them won. And the only one that didn't lose the first debate was Bill Clinton. He managed to just clobber Bob Dole, and, I think Clinton had that get down and deal with ordinary people. It particularly showed in the town hall meetings, particularly showed well against George H.W. Bush, and that's the tape they should be studying carefully this week.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. My guests are John Jackson, visiting professor of political science at the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University, and Alan Lichtman, professor of history at American University in Washington. We're doing a little comparison-contrast today of the 2012 presidential election to election years past. And we welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome questions and comments via WILL's Facebook and Twitter pages. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. The phone numbers again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. We have an email from Subash who writes, what should one think of the American electorate when a known and leading president suddenly becomes the underdog to a vague and flip-flopping challenger after a single hour of debate? Do we qualify to be called a mature democracy? Certainly, clearly, Subash has a point of view on this, but the question here gets back to Professor Lichtman, what you said about this idea of a shifting narrative. Was this a 180 on the part of cable news networks, for example, that there was such a rush to let's reframe the narrative, or is it just an honest assessment of what happened?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think it was a very poor performance on the part of Obama. You know, he was disengaged, he wasn't crisp, he didn't sell his policies, he let Romney get away with all kinds of outrageous accusations, you know, many of which were, if not entirely false, certainly misleading. No question there is reality there, but there's also no question that the media ran with it far more than the reality would indicate. They were ready to pounce on a change in the story. This is dramatic. This is exciting. We now have a real race. By no means, however, does the media say Obama is now the underdog. I think that is not a correct reading of what's in the media. The media has now said, you know, the race is back essentially to where it was before the conventions, a very close, tight, nearly tied race. But the story of the media, with the exception of some of the right-wing media, is that it's now a race, not that Obama is necessarily the underdog. Indeed, I certainly don't believe he is. I have my own system for predicting presidential elections, the 13 keys to the White House.
And I do want to talk about that a little while later.
Okay, I'll leave it at that then.
Okay, yeah, let's tease that for now because I do want to take some calls.
Sure.
We have some folks waiting on the line to speak with each of you. We'll go first to David in Urbana. Good morning.
Good morning. My question is, has any candidate has completely reversed his positions as Romney has in this election campaign, going from trying to appear to be an extreme conservative to perhaps trying to appear to the left of the Democratic candidate?
All right. Thanks very much for the question. Professor Jackson, let me start with you. do see a shift, don't we, for nearly any nominee from the primary contest to the general election campaign?
Well, yeah, but we've never seen a shift this late, and the shift coming in the first debate. I think that was one thing that threw Obama off, and he was standing there flat-footed trying to figure out what he was going to respond to. I agree with a part of what the listener said, but I would take issue with part of it. That is, I think in the debate and in the spin after that, he tried to reverse course on most domestic policy issues. In the speech at VMI yesterday, I take him to be really going further to the hard right and toward the neocon position as I read it. So I think you have to split out the foreign policy as opposed to the domestic policy in terms of where he has shifted recently.
Professor Lichtman?
Yeah, I would agree with that, and I would add one modification or addition, and that is there's a big difference between delivering a speech and actually going out in the debate. Nobody has actually listened to the Romney speech. They're only going to get it mediated through newspapers and radio, television, and the internet. The debate is when you speak directly to the American people, and I would not be shocked at all in the last debate, I believe it's October 22nd, which is on foreign policy, to see Romney move back to the center once again when he's speaking directly to the American people. And again, you need an awake Obama to point out all of these various shifts that Romney has made. I agree with Professor Jackson. I've never seen a candidate who seems as plastic and without principle as Romney, who just seems to be willing to adjust whatever position he has to whatever the political reality is of the moment. I don't think anyone at this point knows what Romney stands for, but there will be this very extreme right-wing element of the Republican Party behind him. And anyone who thinks we're going to have a nice, mellow, moderate government if Romney is elected is sadly deceiving themselves.
All right, let's take another call. We have Rick on the line from Champaign. Hi, Rick.
Hello. Morning. I just want to go back to a previous caller trying to compare John Kerry and Mittens, and if I remember correctly, during Vietnam, John Kerry was doing something different than Mitt Romney and George Bush, for that matter. And we can thank the wonderful people, the Swift Boaters, people like that, and Boone Pickens, who helped finance them. To compare John Kerry with Mitt Romney or George Bush, I just, common man, this whole perception is reality, this beauty contest, it's sad.
So just to try and summarize, I guess the point you're aiming to make is that we should perhaps look more at their biography as well as, stand on issues and other things, and maybe a little less on the personality profiles.
Yeah, the dog and pony show. Actually have, do some work, read a book, get in the weeds a little bit.
All right.
I know it might you may have to turn off American Idol, but hey, maybe you could do it.
So, all right, thanks.
Hey, I appreciate it.
Thanks for the call, Rick. All right, so let me get some response from both of our guests. Let me start with Professor Lichtman. What about this idea that maybe in the end we're fixating too much on the personalities of these candidates, and at least when it comes to these comparisons, we should also look certainly at their records, their biography, the meat of what it is they may do in office?
I couldn't agree more. I think not only we have to look at the biography, we have to look at the fundamentals. We'll talk about the keys to the White House later, but the keys to the White House have to do with governing not campaigning. But again, you got to write a story every day. There's only so much you can do about the biography. There's only so much you can do about the record of governing, whereas there are minute-by-minute, hour-to-hour, day-to-day events in the campaign, which allows the media to write its story and to change its story continually, even if the fundamentals of the campaigns and the candidates have not shifted.
Professor Jackson?
Well, the reason this has been so hard to follow and the debate the other evening was so hard to follow is most Americans don't know very much about economics or tax code and all the other esoteric things they were discussing. Back to my original point, I thought Obama did actually better on the substance, and I think to some extent that's the point the listener was making. I take his point entirely on the biography of John Kerry was dramatically different on Vietnam. I was, of course, talking about stylistic matters and being a patrician from Massachusetts, and in that sense, I think the parallels still stand.
We're exploring parallels between the 2012 presidential election and elections from the past 50 years or so on today's program. My guests are Alan Lichtman, professor of history at American University in Washington, and John Jackson, visiting professor at the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University. We welcome you to the conversation at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-9455. WILL, or email us at willtalk@illinois.edu. And we will take more of your calls and emails after a short break. This is Focus.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear revelations from well-known actors, like Zach Galifianakis on the story behind his last name.
It's actually shortened, Terry. My real last name is Galifianakisberg. That's an exclusive for your show.
Fresh Air, bringing you some of the biggest names in American culture and some of the most difficult to pronounce. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the 6th Annual Disability Expo, Reaching Out for Answers, on Saturday, October 13th from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Lincoln Square Village in Urbana. Over 70 exhibitors will be there to answer questions about resources available in Champaign County. Holly Trent, author of the book Broken, will be signing autographs.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing the presidential election and how it may compare or contrast with past elections in recent memory. Our guests, John Jackson, visiting professor of political science at the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University, and Alan Lichtman, professor of history at American University in Washington. Your questions and comments are welcome this morning as well at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Professor Lichtman, as you alluded to, you've come up with what you characterize as a sort of prediction system, what you call the keys to the White House, which I guess you say you've used to correctly predict the outcomes of, every presidential election since 84?
Correct, 7 in a row.
All right, so what are those keys?
Right, the theory behind the keys is entirely different from everything you hear in the media, which is that it's campaigning that counts. The key suggests that fundamentally it is governing that counts. And basically presidential elections are votes up or down on how well the party in power has governed during the past 4 years. So the 13 keys relate primarily to the strength and performance of the party holding the White House. And they are simple, true-false questions, such as the economy is not in recession during the election year. The incumbent administration has achieved major changes in national policy. The incumbent administration has achieved a major foreign policy success. The incumbent candidate is the sitting president. Always an answer of true favors the reelection of the party holding the White House. And if six or more are false, the party holding the White House loses.
So this really, and it doesn't have to do with the president himself. This has to do with the party in power in the White House.
That's right. It holds whether or not the sitting president is running. However, one of the keys is whether or not the candidate of the party in power is the sitting president. That's a plus.
Okay, so let's take these various statements, and what do they tell you about 2012?
Well, what they tell you about 2012 is that Obama has lost precisely three of the 13 keys. It takes six to count out the party holding the White House. So based on the fundamentals of governing and a system that predictively has held for 28 years, regardless of his awful performance in the debate, Barack Obama is still a predicted winner in November. Although I must say, some of my adversaries out there somewhere must have paid off Barack Obama to do everything possible to prove me wrong.
Well, okay, let me ask you that. You identify three keys, but and you claim these are true-false questions, but could they be subject to interpretation depending on the political point of view, the ideological point of view of whoever's looking at those questions?
Well, this is the hardest thing in being a forecaster. It's not knowing politics. It's not knowing history. It's not knowing math. It's putting aside your own political convictions and answering the questions, number one, impartially, number two, when you buy my book, Keys to the White House 2012, according to how they're defined in the book, and number three, according to how they've been answered, because this system retrospectively goes back to 1860, so how they've been answered over the past 150 years. And when you put all that together, it is not difficult to answer these questions. If you answer them according to your political convictions, you're then useless as a forecaster because you'll be wrong half the time. So since I've been right since 1984, I've lost all my friends. Every 4 years, I really make angry either all my Democratic friends or all my Republican friends.
Let me bring Professor Jackson back in at this point. I don't know if you've had a chance to study Professor Lichtman's keys to the White House, but I imagine you maybe in the back of your mind have your own measures for getting a sense of where a campaign is likely to go based off of previous presidential campaigns. What are some of the factors that you take into account?
Well, I am familiar with his keys, and I think they work very well. I think it's a good system. If you go to a different approach, there's one, I suppose, best-known name is Alan Abramowitz at Emory, where they use just a couple of variables. They're the economic variables that we're all familiar with, and the Abramowitz model, by narrow margin, clearly predicts that Obama will be reelected. I think that's one reason the jobs report on Friday was crucial, even though it's not quite on target with the time period that Abramowitz uses. I'm surprised that the media did not really do as much with it as they did with the debate for all the reasons that we talked about early in the cast. The jobs report shows pretty objectively that Obama's theme that things are slowly getting better is real, and he's got data, and the Labor Department data, I think, prove that, and I think that's ultimately going to prevail. I would add one other point, and that is the battleground states are where the action is. Those battleground states still show an advantage to the president.
Let me add one thing to that. I know everybody, but everybody only talks about the battleground states. Let me say two things. One, since the turn of the 20th century, there have been 28 elections. In 27 of them, the popular vote and the electoral college vote have been coincident. They've not diverged. So whoever wins the popular vote 96% of the time also wins the electoral college vote. So too much can be made of the swing states because the dominoes usually fall on election day. Two, that same Alan Abramowitz, friend of mine who I greatly respect, also did a study of the swing states in 2008 when Obama had enormous advantages in spending and organization over McCain, who was taking federal money, whereas Obama could spend unlimited amounts. And he found that on average, these enormous advantages produced 0.8% boost for Obama. So I think sometimes we can overestimate the swing states and not focus enough about the national swing and the national trends in terms of where an election is going. Although I must say I'm very pleased. I live in Maryland, a non-swing state, so I only get the overflow commercials from Virginia.
In all the comparisons that we've made to past presidential elections and the comparisons that others have made, are there, Professor Lichtman, any elections of the last 50 years or so that have gone overlooked that might provide some valuable insight into this year's campaign and election, even if they're not direct parallels?
Well, I'm always very fond of the 1948 election, in which Harry Truman was widely derided. Everybody thought Truman would lose. There was a poll of about the top 50 pundits taken by Time magazine, and all 50 thought Harry Truman's opponent, Tom Dewey, was going to win, to a large extent because Truman's approval rating was so rotten, you know, 20 points below the 50% mark that people thought he would have to win. But the fundamentals favored Truman. He had very strongly innovated in policy, things like the Truman Doctrine, the National Security Act, fundamentally changed America's position and strengthened it around the world. The post-World War II economy was strong. The country was pretty tranquil. There was a classic example of where the fundamentals overrode the narrative of the campaign.
Professor Jackson, can you think of any other elections?
Well, just to extend that analogy, Harry Truman also preemptively integrated the American military and worked for civil rights when he wasn't expected to do so. I think that helped him, even though it wasn't recognized at the time. Harry Truman advanced a medical health program that in many ways became Medicare, as Lyndon Johnson acknowledged when Medicare was passed. And all the things the president can do without the Congress, Harry Truman tried to do. And I think likewise Obama has tried to do in spite of the Congress. So I think that's a great parallel.
And certainly if we're looking for lessons to draw from 1948 and also from 2000, is don't publish until you know for sure.
Yes, good advice, particularly to the Chicago Tribune.
Professor Jackson, are there any other election years that maybe we haven't talked about yet that have some interesting elements that maybe we could draw some distinction from, some experience from that might be of value here in 2012?
Well, I don't think of a lot. I think I would go back to 96 if I were the president's people and learn from Bill Clinton. He's going to be and has been out campaigning for Obama. And I think Obama's got an awful lot of really good qualities in terms of being president. He has never had quite the common touch of being able to campaign people to people that Bill Clinton had. I've seen a lot of presidents and my time, and Clinton's the best of the bunch in terms of that connecting with ordinary people. And I think that one's one they need to be studying, and I go back to that debate that's coming up. I think learn from Bill Clinton on this.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and there's still time for your questions or comments for Alan Lichtman and John Jackson about parallels between this year's presidential race and past elections. You can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone numbers again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. We'll go next to Susan in Urbana. Hi, Susan.
Hi. As I was painting outside the other day, an awful thought came to mind. I do family history of our family, and I had the chance to stop at the Mormon Family History Library many years ago, and this is before they had their stuff online. I thought I would look and see what I could find about the women in my husband's family, which goes back to the Mayflower, but I wanted to know if there was somebody that wasn't so famous, and I was following back on their computers what people had submitted, and I came all the way back to somebody called Eofric the Pict, like in 500 A.D., and lo and behold, he'd been baptized into the Mormon Church. And I thought, oh, my goodness. I just sat there and laughed out loud. I thought, what would poor Eofric the Pict think about this? And I thought, do I want to contribute my stuff and have my ancestors baptized? But what occurred to me the other day was, Yeah, there's been controversy because the Mormons have baptized people who died in the Holocaust.
Susan, I apologize, but your connection's breaking up a little bit, so I'm going to ask you to try and wrap it up as quickly as you can.
Okay. I'm concerned that when Muslims discover that it's a major tenet and major resource occupier of the Mormon faith to track down who people are and who their ancestors are and then baptize the dead as Mormons, that Muslims will be upset and that the radical Muslims will, that the world will go up in flames practically because of this.
All right. Well, I think we get the basic gist of your point. I'm going to ask our guests to respond, but I guess and couch it in the terms of the subject matter of today's show. There may be a comparison to draw to the 1960 election and concerns that the electorate had and that were raised within the campaign about President Kennedy's Catholic faith. Professor Lichtman?
There definitely were issues raised about President Kennedy's Catholic faith, quite openly. This wasn't just a whispering campaign. And indeed, there is no question that Kennedy's Catholic faith cost him a considerable number of votes among white Protestants. Amazingly, he was elected president while winning only about one-third of the vote of white Protestants in the North. That's just astounding. He probably would have won by a much larger margin, at least in the popular vote, had it not been for the issue of Catholicism. You haven't seen the issue of Romney's Mormonism as openly raised in this campaign, and we are living in an era of greater tolerance. The question is, will that have some implications when people go to the voting booth? And at this point, we have no idea.
I'll get Professor Jackson's reaction to that in just a second, but I do know, Professor Lichtman, that you need to check out our conversation at this point.
I do
want to say thank you for talking with us today.
Anytime. My great pleasure.
That's Alan Lichtman, professor of history at American University in Washington. Remaining with us for these last couple of minutes is John Jackson, visiting professor at the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University. Professor Jackson, any other reaction to the caller's question and point?
Well, I think it is surprising how little religion has been discussed and how little role it's played in this campaign so far, particularly since it's somewhat unprecedented. Another factoid is, this is the first time ever that there hasn't been a white Protestant on either major ticket. Of course, the debate, vice presidential debate, will be two Catholics. Obviously, the question of whether or not Obama is a Muslim, which 20% of Republicans in one poll recently believe he is, has been a background factor. But none of that has really been on the surface, and I think given how unusual this lineup is, that's somewhat surprising.
We have just a couple of minutes left. I want to try and get in at least one more call. Mena is in Charleston. Good morning.
Yes, I watched the debate between Romney and President Obama, and my impression was that Romney did not give specifics, and he was very aggressive. And as a matter of fact, I think I'll be in shock if I had to face him, because I think that's exactly what happened on the stage, because I felt like President Obama was very shocked by the way that he was coming.
Okay. Thank you very much for the comments. I apologize for cutting you short, but I want to give our guest a chance to respond to your comments before we wrap up here. And Professor Jackson, I think, again, another potential parallel to 1960 here in terms of how people responded to the debate last week, depending on whether they were looking at, as you sort of point out, style over substance versus substance over style, or however you want to analyze it.
I think that's right. I think the being succinct, being aggressive, being able to get his points across in bumper sticker approach really pays off, and that's what these debates reward. I think Jim Lehrer did a really lousy job of controlling the debate, and that worked to his advantage as well. I think the parallel with 1960 is an apt one.
And very quickly, we have an email question. How would your guests rate Obama's first term? Should this be a major factor in the race?
Well, that is the key question that Professor Lichtman was raising. I think he's had, by historic measures, a successful first term, and if he gets a second term, I think this first term will have laid the foundation for his ability to claim to have gotten a lot done on both foreign and domestic scene, but he's got to get a second term for that claim to really ring true.
John Jackson is a visiting professor at the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University. Professor Jackson, thanks very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you for having me.
And my thanks again as well to Alan Lichtman from American University. We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. A reminder, you can hear this program twice each weekday at 10 a.m. Central Time live, then repeated weeknights at 8 on WILL AM 580. If you know anybody who might enjoy hearing Focus but can't tune in during the day, let them know about our evening rebroadcast. Same thing goes for anybody who lives outside of our listening area. Let them know we stream this program live every day at will.illinois.edu. You can listen back to past programs there. Each day's show is usually up on the web by early afternoon. Focus is also available as a free downloadable podcast. All of that at will.illinois.edu. This election season, Focus is providing you with the opportunity to speak directly with candidates in two key races, those running for Illinois' newly redrawn 13th Congressional District seat and the candidates seeking to represent you in Illinois' 52nd State Senate District. We will continue on tomorrow's show with the Democratic candidate running for Congress in Illinois' 13th District, David Gill. He faces Republican Rodney Davis and Independent John Hartman. All three candidates are vying to replace retiring Congressman Tim Johnson. We spoke with Hartman last month. We'll speak with Rodney Davis next week. Today's show is produced by Travis Stansel, Kyle Mabries, our technical director. He handled your calls. I'm Craig Cohen.